This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with constitutional scholar and litigator Stephen Rohde on the disaster that's facing the First Amendment if they send Julian Assange back to the United States for trial and imprisonment.
Is there a glimmer of hope they won't extradite him? Stay tuned.
We'll also speak with author Asa Winstanley on his new book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn.
Not only do they weaponize anti-Semitism in Great Britain, but we're also seeing the same tactics used against progressives here in the United States. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. Press freedom is under constant attack, both in the U.S. and around the world. One of the highest profile battles on this front has been the one waged against award-winning Australian journalist, publisher, and founder of the nonprofit media organization WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. In 2010, in partnership with five newspapers, WikiLeaks published a series of documents and other media provided by U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning, including classified documents evidencing war crimes committed by U.S. forces during its war in Iraq. The U.S. has since unsealed indictments against Assange, charging him with a number of crimes that we'll be discussing today. Currently, Assange is languishing in a maximum security prison in London, struggling to maintain his physical health, his sanity, and his connections with loved ones. And in the meantime, an international movement of human rights and press freedom advocates are desperately fighting for his freedom and against his potential extradition to the United States. To bring us up to date on these efforts, we will be speaking with someone today who has been very active in the national campaign to free Julian Assange, Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a constitutional law scholar, author, and past chair of the ACLU of Southern California. He's also one of the founders of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and he's a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books, Truth Dig, and LA Progressive. Stephen Rohde, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Maria and Michael. It's great to be back with you.
Well, as you know, May 3rd, 2023 marked the 30th anniversary of World Press Freedom Day, which the United Nations established to remind governments about the need to respect their commitment to the freedom of the press. But while the Biden administration proclaims the importance of press freedom globally, its hypocrisy in pursuing journalist and publisher Julian Assange is stunning. Is that how you see it?
Well, you bet. The Biden administration expressed outrage recently that Russia arrested a journalist, Evan Gershkovich, of the Wall Street Journal. Here's a U.S. citizen reporting from Moscow, practicing journalism. He's now incarcerated in Russia, facing espionage charges that could garner him over 20 years in prison. Now, of course, he should be released immediately. But the Biden administration continues to demand the extradition to the U.S. of an Australian national, Julian Assange, for obtaining and publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes. Both Gershkovich and Assange are journalists detained in a foreign country on espionage charges for doing what journalists do. Assange, as we tragically know, has been locked up in a maximum security prison in London for 4 years, while the Biden administration continues Trump's attempts to prosecute him under the notorious Espionage Act of 1917. If Assange is extradited and convicted, he could face 175 years in prison. And if all of that hypocrisy wasn't enough, in March, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Biden had the gall to declare that journalism is not a crime. If he really meant that, he would release Assange immediately.
Absolutely. Steve, please remind our listeners of the basis on which the Trump administration indicted Assange.
Well, no conversation about Assange should go farther than this without talking about the important work of WikiLeaks and Assange himself. It was in 2010, in collaboration with the New York Times, The Guardian, El Paz, Le Monde, and Der Spiegel, that WikiLeaks published 251,000 U.S. State Department cables. The New York Times said those documents revealed the unvarnished story of how the government makes its biggest decisions that cost the country most heavily in lives and money. In addition to being indicted for that, Assange was indicted for the revelation of the Iraq war logs, which were 400,000 field reports. But one of the key revelations was that there had been 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians and systematic rape and torture by U.S. forces. That's the kind of information he was revealing, which now he is charged with a crime. And then many of us have seen the deplorable 2007 collateral murder video, which shows a U.S. Army Apache helicopter targeting and killing 11 unarmed civilians. Two of those were Reuters news staff simply carrying cameras, not weapons, and they wounded two children. That video is actual evidence of the violations of the Geneva Convention and the U.S. Army Field Manual. Also, we know that in March of 2017, WikiLeaks revealed the Vault 7 document. That included the Year Zero documents, over 8,700, showing how the CIA has been hacking Apple iPhones, Google Androids, and Microsoft Windows, converting them into covert microphones, recording people around the world, including U.S. citizens. Those revelations, we believe, caused the CIA to become even more aggressive toward prosecuting Assange.
Wasn't the CIA and Mike Pompeo involved in discussions about kidnapping or even assassinating Assange?
Yes, I would cover that in the consequences, but we now have evidence that the CIA developed plans to kidnap and go as far as assassinating Assange. That's why we need a WikiLeaks, because you're not hearing about those revelations in the corporate media. It is shocking when you consider what an agency of the U.S. government was considering and planning, and it's why this case is so important.
Stephen Rohde, what is the current status of the U.S. effort to get Assange extradited from the U.K. to the U.S.? And what have been some of the biggest challenges?
Well, this is ultimately a tragic story, because in January of 2021, Assange actually scored an important victory. Now, here he is in Belmarsh Prison. The U.S. government is seeking to extradite him. In January of 2021, a U.K. judge actually rejected the U.S. application for extradition. That judge found that to extradite Assange to the United States into maximum security in the U.S. prison system would be oppressive and would risk his mental health and the potential of suicide. Now, the case could have ended there. This was the time of the Biden administration. Biden had a perfect reason to let the Trump indictment end there. But instead, Biden and Merrick Garland appealed that decision of the UK judge through the higher courts of England, and they were overturned by the British High Court in December of 2021 on the basis of, quote, assurances from the U.S. government that Assange would be treated nicely. It's the only way I can put it. They promised that when there's been all kinds of evidence of the kind of abuse in the American prison system. Well, untiringly, the Assange lawyers continued his appeal. It's been years, but tragically, this month, on June 6th, a single high court judge in London denied Assange's permission to pursue the rest of his appeals, which raised serious grounds, including the fact that the UK-US extradition treaty does not allow extradition for political offenses, which is precisely what the Assange prosecution is. Instead, in a very brief and cursory opinion, that one judge said that the grounds raised no arguable points, and he separately dismissed eight other grounds for appeal. In response to that ruling, Assange's wife, Stella, who's been doing such an extraordinary job across the world in urging her husband's innocence, she said that, and it did happen, that the appellate team filed the necessary papers to ask for a public hearing before two new judges at the High Court. Stella said she remained optimistic that he would eventually prevail. We're waiting now to see if those two judges will order a public hearing and give him another chance to appeal. If that fails, in the UK system, Assange can review the case in the European Court of Human Rights. And I do want to add here on a different level that two courageous lawyers, Margaret Kuntzler and Deborah Herbeck, have filed a civil suit in New York, in the Southern District of New York, because of the following fact. It turns out that every time they, as Assange's lawyers, visited him in the Ecuadorian embassy and as a routine security matter had their cell phones taken, the Spanish company that was providing so-called security for the Ecuadorian embassy was in fact recording their visits with Julian Assange, as well as other visitors to Julian, and were providing that information, the suit alleges, to the CIA as part of this overall effort to surveil and undermine Julian Assange's defense. Now, those are shocking revelations. They are fully documented in the case of Kuntzler versus Pompeo. Mike Pompeo is named as an individual defendant in that civil case. The government and Pompeo filed a motion to dismiss. Legal papers have been exchanged there in New York. Further papers are due in July, and there'll be a hearing in this case. This case is so important because it's a vehicle to reveal the improper conduct and prosecutorial misconduct that's been going on. It, frankly, on an entire separate ground, should lead to the dismissal of the criminal charges against Assange, as other evidence of the use of perjured testimony and other improprieties come to light. If this case was not such a travesty of judgment of justice, these revelations reveal that it's probably one of the grossest examples of improper prosecution by the U.S. government in recent memory.
Well, it was the prosecutorial misconduct that got the Daniel Ellsberg case thrown out. There's no difference between Ellsberg's case and this one. Steve Rohde, recently there's been a groundswell of support for Assange in the United States and around the world. Could you please remind our listeners about what's been happening lately?
I'm so glad you mentioned Daniel Ellsberg. He's been a hero of mine. I was privileged to work with him on the Assange Defense Committee, in which he is one of the three co-chairs. He is an example of an extraordinary, courageous individual, and most of your listeners know of his courage in connection with the Pentagon Papers case. But he was equally courageous in defending Julian Assange. It's worth taking a moment to realize that on the spectrum, Daniel Ellsberg was in the position of a leaker, much as the courageous Chelsea Manning was in this case. Julian Assange is a publisher on that side of the equation. But Julian Assange was in the position of the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. This often gets lost in the demonization of Julian Assange. That's why they called it the New York Times problem, because under the Obama administration, his DOJ would not indict Assange, because how could they stop there without indicting the New York Times? Fortunately, there is that groundswell of support for Julian Assange. Last November, the New York Times itself, along with all of those other newspapers that had made the early revelation, issued a joint open letter urging the U.S. government to dismiss the espionage charges against Assange for publishing those classified secrets. In that letter, these publications said that publishing is not a crime, and the U.S. government should end its prosecution of Julian Assange for publishing secrets. Then on the fourth anniversary of Assange's arrest, many representatives in Congress sent a letter to Merrick Garland seeking the dismissal of the Assange charges. That letter was signed by Rashida Tlaib, Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush, Greg Cesar, AOC, Ilhan Omar, and Ayaan Pressley. They urged the Department of Justice to affirm First Amendment protection. And they wrote as follows: press freedom, civil liberty, and human rights groups have been emphatic that the charges against Mr. Assange pose a grave and unprecedented threat to everyday constitutionally protected journalistic activity, and that a conviction would represent a landmark setback for the First Amendment. They echoed what the ACLU, Amnesty International, Reporters Without Borders, Human Rights Watch, Defending Rights and Dissent, and the Committee to Protect Journalists had said in a previous letter, that this sets an unprecedented example. Never before has a publisher on the publisher side of the equation been charged for common journalistic practices under the espionage. The groundswell of support that you ask about is worldwide. Major governmental leaders in Australia, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, Germany, UK have spoken out. 50 UK parliament members have, 75 Australian legislators have. The Council of Europe Commissioner for Human Rights has spoken out, and Rebecca Vinson at Reporters Without Borders said as long as the case against Assange continues, it will be a thorn in the side of the U.S. government and undermines U.S. efforts to defend media freedom globally. Well, that's the irreducible consequence of this. I don't care too much about the U.S. reputation. What I care about is reuniting Julian Assange with his wife and his two children and to strike a blow in favor of freedom of the press.
Yes, that is such a great point. For local listeners, are there upcoming events being organized in support of Julian Assange, actually locally or around the country?
Well, today, July 3rd, is Julian's birthday, and an extraordinary effort is being made to make the day a literally banner day in the effort to free Julian Assange. Through the Assange Defense Committee, over 150 banners, giant banners, saying free Assange, journalism is not a crime, have been distributed throughout the United States in 150 locations. Today, those banners will be displayed. We're hoping it will cause attention in the corporate mainstream media to draw attention to Assange's case. We hope everyone in every community will rally, will organize and demonstrate around those banners and those locations. In addition, today is Julian's birthday, and there is an entire effort to send either real or electronic birthday cards to Julian Assange. That can be done on a continuing basis, even if you're only hearing of it today on his birthday. In all of these efforts, everyone can go to AssangeDefense.org, and there is an individual, Vinny DiStefano, who is the national organizing director, and he has given permission for anyone to contact him at Vinny, V-I-N-N-I-E, at AssangeDefense.org to join in these national and international efforts. And then I hasten to add that everyone listening to this, if you've learned something today new or important about the Julian Assange case, the key is reaching Attorney General Merrick Garland and President Joe Biden. Please make phone calls today. Say that in the celebration of Julian Assange's birthday, the extradition should be dropped and Julian Assange should be freed. You can send emails and calls to the White House, to the Department of Justice. That's being done on a daily basis by organizers across the country. You have ample materials to look at AssangeDefense.org, which has an action page with sample letters and messages. I do believe and still cling to the idea that the Constitution does begin with the words, "We the people." And when you have such an egregious case as the one of Julian Assange, I think this is high time people spoke up for the sake of Julian Assange personally and for the sake of the broader challenge and defense of freedom of the press.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Maria Hall, and we're speaking with constitutional litigator and scholar Steve Rohde. Steve, could you please repeat that website for the Assange Defense Committee?
Yes, it's one of the easiest to remember, AssangeDefense.org. You can go there and see all of the information we've talked about today, updates on the case, and the action page.
I just wanted to remark, Steve, that this case is really the most important First Amendment case in our lifetime. And after all, the First Amendment is what our form of democracy is based on. If we lose it, we're in a lot of trouble.
I couldn't agree more. I think in the annals, this will go down among the major free speech and press freedom cases of our lifetime. I hope everybody appreciates the importance of that. But instead of treating it as a curiosity and moving on today in their busy lives.
Yeah, well, Michael Ratner, one of the founders of Law and Disorder, was Assange's first American lawyer. He represented Julian till the day he died 7 years ago.
You're right, and I went to law school with Michael. I have the deepest respect for his legacy, and I hope everybody will take into consideration that he is the kind of person that fought for press freedom, for civil rights and human rights. And in his name and in the name of other heroes like him, including Daniel Ellsberg, Americans should be rising up and calling for the release of Julian Assange.
Well, Stephen Rohde, we certainly appreciate your work as well. And please let listeners know where they can read more of your writings about Assange and other important civil and human rights topics.
Well, thank you. Most of my work is collected at the Los Angeles Review of Books website, LARB. I actively now write for Truth Dig and LA Progressive and other publications. Those are available on the web. I personally have made this a commitment. I'm going to continue to do this work, and I'm proud of you guys for giving it so much attention.
Steve Rohde, before we let you go, unfortunately we've run out of our allotted time, but before we let you go, I think that most profoundly this case represents the trashing of the rule of law. Wouldn't you agree?
We're seeing so many signs of that. Only last week, the conservative Supreme Court dismantled affirmative action. They threw a bone to the First Amendment in one case this term. But there is such a judicial hypocrisy in this field of paying lip service to free speech, paying lip service to freedom of the press, and instead in the actual work of the CIA, of the Department of so-called Justice, we see this kind of undermining. We can all be appalled at the insurrection on January 6th and the illegality of ex-President Trump and his enablers. But so long as official U.S. government policy and activism is to prosecute and persecute an individual like Julian Assange, we can not rest in any sense that the U.S. is a beacon of liberty and the rule of law. We have much to be held accountable for. What should be happening is those who committed war crimes in the collateral murder video and throughout the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, those are the people that should be in the dock. Those are the people that should be criminally charged. And yet, decade after decade, government officials that have openly and blatantly violated the law, they walk scot-free, while a courageous individual like Julian Assange sits in jail.
Well, thank you so much, Steve Rohde. We're all sitting on pins and needles knowing that Assange could be extradited to the United States for trial any minute now, and we'll be in touch with you on this. Thanks again for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you both very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Asa Winslee has written an important book called Weaponizing Anti-Semitism: How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn. The book has lessons for those of us working for social justice here in the USA. The main lesson is, don't placate them. Corbyn and the Socialists and the Labour Party in England were crushed by the mounting of a massive campaign cynically labeling Corbyn as an anti-Semite. It was a preposterous charge, but it stuck. The neoliberal Labour Party changed after the influx of several hundred thousands of young people and elected longtime socialist activist Jeremy Corbyn as its leader in 2015. Despite the huge campaign against him led by the Israeli lobby, Corbyn was almost elected as the prime minister in 2017. Over the years, socialist Corbyn became popular, especially among hundreds of thousands of young people who had recently joined the Labour Party. He got his start in the trade union movement. He spoke out against racism and fascism and for immigrant rights. He opposed privatization cuts and austerity. He campaigned against wars and military occupations. Asa Winstanley writes that probably more than anything else, Corbyn was known among activists for his involvement in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. The possibility of Corbyn being elected terrified the right and its allies. The Israeli lobby's campaign against Corbyn got help from British intelligence, the entire British media, the right wing in England, the right wing of the Labour Party, and even the CIA. The most powerful, well-heeled part of the American pro-Israeli lobby is APAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. Justice Democrats wrote that it is a sinister right-wing group. They supported Donald Trump, endorsed 106 insurrection Republicans, and spent millions to defeat progressives, targeting and trying to intimidate black and brown women candidates across the country, threatening to spend against them if they even slightly criticized Israel's far-right apartheid policies. They conflate criticism of Israel's apartheid state with anti-Semitism. Today we speak with Asa Winstanley. He's an investigative journalist and author who writes primarily about Palestine and the Israeli lobby. He lives in London. He's an associate editor with the Electronic Intifada, the world's leading Palestinian news site in the English language. Asa Winstanley, welcome to Law and Disorder. I just want to say that your book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn, is a great book, a real necessity, and it reads like a thriller. It's a page-turner. So congratulations for producing Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, a very fine book.
Well, thanks a lot for that. Appreciate it. It's great to be with you.
Asa, in 2015, socialist anti-racist Jeremy Corbyn became the leader of the Labour Party in England. What was his political history, and how and why did he get support, and from whom?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn is somebody who's been in the Labour Party for many decades, really all his life, and he has always been on the left of the Labour Party. You know, the mainstream British media describe him as the far left, but that's not really what he is. He's really a socialist, a social democrat. You know, he's very strongly in favour of democracy and peace. He's somebody who has been involved in the anti-war movement for many, many decades. He's somebody who has been involved in solidarity movements all around the world, justice movements, anti-racist movements, and he's certainly someone who's on the left of the Labour Party, and he's someone who's involved in popular movements. And this is the thing, he is an MP, but he was really on the backbenches of the Labour Party for many years before he became the leader, and he was really someone who was involved in the grassroots of campaigning rather than the leadership of his party. He was, for really most of his career, opposed to the leadership of his party, especially during the Tony Blair years, when Tony Blair, the former Labour Prime Minister and his party leader, was taking Britain into the illegal and destructive and violent occupation of Iraq with George Bush.
Well, thank you for that. And that segues into a question I have. How was Jeremy Corbyn different from the neoliberal Labour Party under Tony Blair that supported the Iraq War?
Yeah, he was night and day different. He was the complete opposite, essentially. Tony Blair, I mean, this is something I mentioned in the book. A really interesting historical fact is that Margaret Thatcher, who was really Britain's equivalent to Ronald Reagan, you know, she ushered in the neoliberal era of privatization and really dismantling the welfare state of Britain and selling off nationalized industries and selling off the railways and so forth. A really interesting historical fact is that Margaret Thatcher once said that her greatest achievement was Tony Blair and New Labour, because Tony Blair and New Labour took the Labour Party away from its roots of being a socialist party and continuing the legacy of Margaret Thatcher and neoliberalism. Jeremy Corbyn represented the polar opposite of that. He was somebody who campaigned for renationalisation of industries. You know, when he first ran for the leadership of the Labour Party in 2015, he proposed policies like renationalising the railways. So Britain's railways they used to be just one national company owned by the government. Well, now, because of the neoliberal era, they're all owned by corporations and run for profit for the benefit of shareholders, and there's this kind of chaos of all these different companies running different lines, and that's incredibly unpopular throughout the whole country, throughout all voters, really. I mean, even Conservative Party voters say they want the railways to be renationalised. That was something Corbyn proposed, so it was very, you know, it was actually very moderate policies that he was proposing. But more than anything else, Jeremy Corbyn was a peace movement activist. So I mentioned before about how Tony Blair led the country into the war in Iraq. At the same time as that was happening, Jeremy Corbyn was with us. He was with us on the streets, marching against the war, and he was, you know, leading rallies and giving speeches against the war. I think this really kind of anti-imperialist part of his politics, and especially his support for the Palestine Solidarity Movement, made him a real target of all kinds of vested interests in trying to stop him becoming prime minister.
Asa Winstanley, as a socialist head of the Labour Party, he almost became the prime minister in 2017, losing narrowly. Why was he defeated? Please talk about the campaign that called him an anti-Semite. After all, he himself stated that he'd been an anti-racist his entire life. Did his detractors conflate opposition to Israeli government policies with respect to Palestinians with anti-Semitism?
Well, on the latter point, yeah, absolutely they did. And this is really the focus of my book. He came very, like, as you said, he became very, very close to becoming prime minister in 2017. So the general election in 2017 was an election that was called earlier than it was due to be held, because the ruling Conservative Party was, you know, very confident at the time. You know, Jeremy Corbyn was seen as an unpopular candidate, and so the mainstream wisdom had it. And the ruling Prime Minister, Theresa May at the time, she had, because of Britain's really undemocratic electoral system, she'd never won an election, so she wanted her own electoral mandate. And her advisors told her that, you know, because Jeremy Corbyn's unpopular and he's this far-left extremist and so on and so forth, all this kind of nonsense they used to portray him as, they said, you should go for an election so you can increase your majority, because they had a very narrow majority in Parliament and she couldn't get much of her agenda done. So they went for this election. But then what happened was really unexpected, was that when the general public in Britain actually saw Jeremy Corbyn's policies put in front of the electorate in a general election campaign, when they saw what he actually stood for, the more they saw it and saw beyond these scare story media headlines, the more they liked it. They liked the fact that he was anti-war. They liked the fact that he said, you know, we need to move beyond this era of Britain sending troops overseas to kill and be killed, and we need to find peaceful solutions. They liked his policies of having just general forms of, you know, just dignity for normal working people, basically. Very moderate reforms in the country, just things like ending homelessness and free school meals for children and so forth. The more they saw that, the more people liked it. And he came very, very close. He came within a few thousand votes of actually winning. And it was seen as a really stunning, although it wasn't an outright victory, he didn't win the election overall. He reduced Theresa May's majority in Parliament. Like, she, the Prime Minister, the Conservative Prime Minister, she was expecting to increase a majority, but the opposite happened. And that really led to her political downfall, and she was replaced soon after with another Conservative Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. Really, what happened was, the reason why Jeremy Corbyn didn't win that election overall, although he made advances, was that he was sabotaged internally from within his own party. So although he had the backing of his own, he had the backing of the people, he had the backing of the mass movement, he had the backing of the grassroots, the membership of the Labour Party, which was hundreds of thousands of people. It was more than 500,000 at the height of Corbyn's popularity. He had that backing, but the establishment within the party, the majority of Labour MPs, about three quarters of Labour MPs, opposed him actively and openly. Some of them just were very openly campaigning against him, almost to lose. They were campaigning almost to lose their own seats, and some of them did lose their own seats as a result. And the party establishment as well, the party bureaucracy, undermined him. They worked against their own party. These paid workers for the party, they worked against Jeremy Corbyn because they wanted to see him lose. They didn't want to have a socialist prime minister. And so because of all that internal sabotage within the party and the fact that Corbyn never had full control of the bureaucracy, it was very detrimental, you know, and he could have won if it wasn't for that. Certainly in 2017, he could have become prime minister.
Asa Winstanley, can you talk about what role fear played in getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn and his left supporters who were building a genuine socialist Labour Party? For example, in your book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, you discuss McCarthyism and Arthur Miller's play The Crucible about the witch hunt in colonial America and the witch hunt in 1950s against communism and socialism. Talk about this, please.
There was all kinds of smear campaigns thrown up against Jeremy Corbyn. So the British media really sort of excelled itself in its just relentless propaganda against maintaining the status quo, essentially. What they did was they basically threw anything at him. There was all kinds of ridiculous scare stories, like there was this, the security services, Britain's spy agencies, basically started leaking like mad to the press. And at one point they claimed that Jeremy Corbyn during the Cold War, was a spy for the communist government of Czechoslovakia, which was completely untrue. But nonetheless, it was headlines for a short while. Corbyn, to his credit, sued over that. He sued for libel over that and actually won and donated the winnings to charity. And there was just lots of other stuff like that. But the most successful smear campaign of all was this idea that he was anti-Semitic, or at least that the people around him were anti-Semitic, and that the Labour Party had become this kind of wretched hive of scum and villainy, and that it was full of all these terrible left-wing anti-Semites. Well, you know, 99.99 cases out of 100, that was just completely untrue, and what was actually being called quote-unquote anti-Semitic was actually opposition to Israel, opposition to Zionism, and opposition to the settler colonial project that is occupying Palestine. Sometimes in crude terms, for sure, like people sometimes say things that are over the top and maybe a bit crass, but, you know, in most cases, what was being said was not really anti-Semitic. And what was attacked in Jeremy Corbyn and in the pro-Corbyn movement was actually support for Palestinian human rights, support for Palestinian equality, and just generally left-wing politics as well. It's become a very powerful weapon in the right-wing arsenal. In the world in general now, we can say, you know, and a lot of it is down to what has happened in Britain over the last 8 years or so. And as you said, yes, there's a great amount of fear. You know, at the height of it in the Labour Party, there was people being kicked out of the Labour Party constantly. You know, people were being suspended. They were being disciplined by internal party bureaucrats. They were being kicked out, you know, and it started with really high profile supporters of Corbyn. You know, the former mayor of London, the former Labour mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, who was really a stalwart of anti-racist campaigns in the 70s and especially the 80s, at a time when supporting black people and supporting anti-racist campaigns wasn't very popular, certainly not in the mainstream media, which was just very openly racist a lot of the time in the 80s. At those times, Ken Livingstone was supporting, you know, equality for black and brown people, and he was supporting gay rights at a time when it was actually quite unpopular in the country. Fast forward to 2016, and he's being smeared and attacked as this terrible anti-Semite within the Labour Party. And he was suspended from the Labour Party and eventually forced to leave the Labour Party. And it was just a really terrible assault on the most high-profile supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. There was then an immense amount of fear, because it meant that what Ken Livingstone had said about the reality of the history of the collusion of the German Zionist movement in the 1930s with the Nazis, the German Nazis, historical facts, it meant that, you know, that was became basically verboten. Like, you weren't allowed to say that in any kind of public forum. And it extended into wider society. And there really is an immense amount of fear that is really still going.
This is Attorney Michael Smith at Law and Disorder. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall. We're speaking with Asa Winstanley in London. He has just had published his excellent book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn. You can get it at orbooks.com. What was and what is the relationship between the Israeli lobby in England, and I would also say in the United States, but what was the relationship between the Israeli lobby in England and the Israeli government?
Yeah, this is a really good question, because quite often the Israel lobby, pro-Israel groups in Britain and America and all around the world, they just sort of portray themselves as, oh, we're just normal sort of grassroots supporters and campaigners of Israel, you know, for Israel. More insidiously, they actually portray themselves as Jewish community groups, as representatives of the entire Jewish community, as if all Jews support Israel and Zionism, which, as we know, is completely untrue. But the reality is that pro-Israel groups, the lobby, if you will, the pro-Israel lobby, works hand in glove with the State of Israel. It's been very well documented and proven that there is a high degree of coordination that goes on with a lot of these groups and the actual State of Israel itself, but it's kept quite secretive, you know, it's kept behind closed doors. I mean, if you know what to look for, it's quite clear to see. I mean, you can just take one recent example, which, you know, falls outside of the time period of my book, because it happened, I think, soon after it was published. Or anyway, the most recent example of the Israel lobby campaign against Roger Waters, the founder of Pink Floyd and still a very popular touring musician, who uses his massive platform to support all kinds of campaigns for justice and equality and human rights, and especially the Palestinian people. He uses his platform to support Palestinian people. Well, he is a massive campaign for the Israel lobby. Like, he's a massive target of the Israel lobby. And in the most recent campaign by the Israel lobby against Roger Waters, where they were trying to get his dates for his tour in Europe cancelled, that he wouldn't be allowed to play his music in Germany and London. They came close to succeeding in Germany. They had less success in London. But in all cases, actually, Roger Waters fought back and he won. What was being said about Roger Waters was that he was an anti-Semite. Well, it was completely untrue. But it didn't stop them sort of spewing these smears and lies against him. And you could see the way it went. I mean, just even on social media, you could see it was quite openly done, actually, in this case. What happened was that Israeli state's social media accounts, their official social media accounts, started tweeting all these lies against Roger Waters, saying that he was a Nazi on stage and all these kinds of things, and that there was a pig with the Star of David at his concert in Germany and all this kind of thing. But then what happened was, literally within hours and the next day or two, the pro-Israel lobby group started parroting exactly the same pictures, exactly the same attack lines, and you could see it happening, especially in Britain, because that's where Roger Waters' tour was happening next, and they were trying to get initial momentum going for Roger Waters' tour in Britain to be cancelled. It didn't work out for them, thankfully, but you could see these pro-Israel groups, like the Board of Deputies of British Jews, a very, very active pro-Israel group, which admits in its internal documents that it works closely with the embassy of the State of Israel in the UK, the Israeli military spokesperson, and even Israel's secretive Ministry of Strategic Affairs. They parroted the lines of the Israeli government very soon after against Roger Waters, and so did other pro-Israel groups. So that's just one example. You know, the pro-Israel lobby works in very close coordination with the Israeli state. It's not necessarily as simple as every single thing these pro-Israel groups is directed by the Israeli government. No, it's a bit more complicated than that. But nonetheless, it is a fact. There is direction that happens. And it comes, it literally, as Roger Waters actually said on stage, it literally does come from Tel Aviv, a lot of it. So, you know, it is a fact. The coordination happens. And Al Jazeera in its undercover investigations also gave a lot of evidence of that.
Asa Winstanley, you've written in your book, speaking of your book, Weaponizing Antisemitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn, that he was defeated by the right wing inside the Labour Party, the entire media, and the conservatives in Great Britain, and all with the help of British intelligence and even the CIA. Please talk about this.
Yeah, this is really interesting, and I opened my book with it because I wanted to contextualize it a bit more. My book, obviously, it's my area of expertise, and it was the area of my focus was to focus on the Israel lobby aspect of it. But, you know, as you said, there was a unity, an ad hoc unity of interests between all these forces of the status quo that wanted to oppose Jeremy Corbyn. And we saw that there was a quite open involvement of the British forces, British security services, in other words, British spies, MI5 and MI6, who are Britain's equivalent of the FBI and the CIA, quite openly briefing journalists. My friend Matt Kennard, a really good investigative journalist for an outlet called Declassified UK, he did a good story on this a few years ago while Corbyn was still running for Prime Minister in 2019. And he did an analysis of the media coverage of Jeremy Corbyn, and he found 34 open examples where British papers and media outlets had openly sourced their attack stories, their information, from British intelligence and British military sources. So in the newspapers, it would say, according to a security source, which means a British spy, essentially. So, you know, the spies obviously were not named and not given personal names, but they came from security, intelligence and military sources. And all of these stories, these 34 stories, were portraying Jeremy Corbyn as a threat to national security. In one way or another. So this was what was being done openly. And so we can only imagine what they were doing privately, secretly, covertly, behind the scenes to target people who want change, who want radical change in public life and want the government to take a different direction. We know that the British security services, very similar to the FBI and the CIA, acts to subvert that kind of change.
Asa Winstanley, supporters of Israel in the U.S. and in England use the same tactics. What lessons can we learn from Jeremy Corbyn's defeat? You're critical of him for placating the Israeli lobby for its lies and manufacturing a crisis. Please talk about this.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, look, I like Jeremy Corbyn. There's no doubt about it. Like, he's a nice guy, personally. I did interview him once in 2015. And I think, unlike most politicians in Britain and in America, and probably most politicians in general in the West, he actually has the right political instincts most of the time. You know, he's against war. He's for equality, human rights. He's against racism. And, you know, he wants just a decent standard of living for most people. But at the same time, I think it's important to face up to the lessons of when, you know, the movement gets things wrong. And I think Jeremy Corbyn was the victim of a lot of bad advice, where he heard that, oh, you know, if we just concede to some of this and kind of sweep it under the rug, we can kind of move on. You know, if we just say, okay, yes, there has been some anti-Semitism, and we're sorry for that, and I oppose anti-Semitism, then we can just move on and get on with our program. And this in particular was kind of the line that his colleague John McDonnell, I think, was saying a lot of the time, and he was saying that quite publicly. And we just saw that this didn't work. You know, the line that was always put out was, I oppose anti-Semitism. This was what Jeremy Corbyn was saying all the time. Now, who could disagree with that? Of course, we all oppose prejudice against Jewish people and discrimination and the sort of stereotyping of Jewish people in a essentially racist fashion. Who could disagree with that? But the problem is, when you say, if that's your line all the time, that if you just say, I'm against anti-Semitism, this is what you kept saying over the years, you're then giving the impression to the wider electorate, to the movement within the Labour Party, that maybe there is a bit of, you know, no smoke without fire kind of thing. And so it was a problem. And when you get these kind of false weaponized allegations of anti-Semitism, you have to stand up to them. You have to be able to say openly and clearly, no, this isn't true. This is a smear. Yes, of course, we all oppose anti-Semitism, but nonetheless, in this case, this is a false allegation of anti-Semitism that is being deployed against me because I am a supporter of Palestinian human rights. And that's what people like Ken Livingstone did, and an MP, a left-wing MP, Chris Williamson, and they were basically chased out of the party because they did do that. And Jeremy Corbyn unfortunately never did that, and ultimately that helped lead to his defeat. And so I think the lesson to be learned is that these kinds of smear campaigns, you can't sweep them under the rug. You can't just say, oh, okay, well, you know, if we just sort of concede to a few demands, it will go away. It won't. You know, the Israel lobby is ruthless. The state of Israel is very ruthless to its enemies. And you can see how it treats Palestinians. It treats all its perceived enemies in a very similarly ruthless fashion. It never goes away. These false anti-Semitism, weaponized anti-Semitism allegations is something that Israel's been doing for decades. And so they're never going to stop it. You can't just sweep it under the rug. It has to be opposed and defeated. And I think that's the lesson that needs to be learned.
Well, thank you so much, Asa Winstanley. Thank you for writing your excellent book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism. You can get it at orbooks.com. The astute editor at OR Books, Colin Robinson, gave it that intelligent title. We're grateful to him. We're grateful for you, Asa. And before we let you go, in a nutshell, how can people follow your work?
Yes, well, thank you for the kind words about my book. It's really appreciated. You know, I was working on it for quite a few years, and I am a reporter for the Electronic Intifada, and you can follow all my work by subscribing to my Substack, which is on asawinstanley.substack.com. There's free and paid options, and I put out all my work there, and there's original work on there as well as the republications for my EI and my appearances in media outlets such as yourself.
Thank you again, Asa Winstanley, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.